flurries of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind, from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. On January 17th, Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+, and we can't wait for you guys to see it.
And before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recap podcasts.
Yep. Each weekday beginning January 7th, we'll be dropping an episode featuring exclusive behind-the-scenes tidbits and brilliant insights from our cast and crew and us.
Patricia Arquette, Britt Lauer, Zach Cherry, John Turturro, the list goes on.
All your favorite Lumen employees, their friends, families, enemies, in your feed every single weekday.
And here's the best part. After that, we're going to keep going. Tune in weekly as we recap every episode of season 2. The podcast drops on the same day the episode comes out.
It's the Severance Podcast with Ben and Adam.
On Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And good morning, good Saturday, good weather. It's a little bit of a warmish one. Scott Mosby here sitting in for Rich Orris, who is on a much-needed break from the toils of the day. Rich Orris off, Scott Mosby on. I'm glad to be back here. And we've got 2 full hours today of the KMOX Home Improvement Show. So nice to see you, hear you, be back together with the KMOX family. Phone lines, as always, 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900. Scott Mosby at your service, 2 full hours. The topics today are whatever you think needs to be addressed around your home. Maybe things like furnace filters. What are the various gauges and numbers? What do those furnace filters mean? How do you set a thermostat if you're going to use a setback thermostat? How many degrees is it appropriate to set back your thermostat? All those things that matter. When you're replacing an air conditioner unit, all the choices of what is variable speed, what is continuous speed motor, what is the difference in the cost and the benefit, why do I care as a consumer? 314-436-7900. Also lighting, light bulbs, things around the home, even discussions on interiors from carpeting to hard floors to tile. What's the difference between ceramic tile, porcelain tile? How do they last? What about glass tile? How do we put up glass tile? For all you do-it-yourself warriors at home, I'm yours. Think of me as your predetermined or pre-disastered research and development. If I haven't made the mistake yet, I'm working on it as we speak. So I can tell you what not to do and some of the things we've stumbled over in our 75 years of business at Mosby Building Arts. My wife and I are owners of Mosby Building Arts and very happy to be part of a good team that we're proud of. And maybe you are too, for all of you out there. They keep me sharp. They keep me aware. I keep Rich Orris on the horse so that he's got the current materials, experience, and knowledge. What Rich and I share that we both enjoy doing really can't help ourselves. We enjoy figuring things out, which is how we're both on the radio. So anyway, I've spent, golly, I forget what it was, 27, 28 years on KMOX. I enjoyed it, and the reason I kind of backed away was time. It was time to kind of figure out the other parts of my life. And also, not quite as quick and sharp as I once was. I remember the products. Golly, that name escapes me a little bit, so anyway, that's why I'm here for you. 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900, Scott Mosby at your service. Let's go right to the phone lines and see what's cooking here and talk to Bob. Hey, Bob, good morning. Welcome to KMOX. How can I help, sir?
Yeah, Mark, if I call your office, can you recommend me a roofer?
Sure, sure. 314-909-1800, 909-1800.
909?
1-0-1-800. 909-1800. Yep, 314-909-1800. And we keep a list of referrals, companies we use all the time. And, you know, they fall from grace and they're off the list. And we find a hero and they go back on the list. So,
appreciate it.
You're welcome, Bob. Good luck, my friend. Hey, Bob, when you're interviewing a roofing company, I know you were looking for a roofer there. One of the things, there are shingle appliers, applicators, you know, they can nail the shingles down, and they will do, you know, kind of attic ventilation. The one differentiator for me is when a roofer or an insulation company takes me into attic ventilation. And we discuss, you know, ridge vents, pan vents, all the various ways to ventilate the attic. Because, frankly, they're going to tear the roof off. They're doing it all back. The easiest, cheapest time to put roof ventilation is during and with the roofer. If you have a guy that's just nailing shingles on, probably isn't going to bring it up, not too fluent. We put on whatever we take off. You know, that means you've got kind of shade tree mechanic, if you will. When you've got somebody that really wants to talk about the attic and the roof and even the gutters and all that as a system, now you've got a roofer that's going to look ahead into ice dams, snow and ice buildup in the valleys, north, south, east, west, all those sorts of things that are subtle, but they make that roof perform under the extreme condition. Anybody can, you know, keep the water out of the house. The issue is when you get some of these torrential rain downpours and the rain is blowing up the valley, up under the shingles, or you've got severe ice damage where you have warm and cold and warm and cold, and you start building up ice on the gutters and ice dams on the edge of the roof. That's when those leaks occur, because you kind of have to build for your toughest conditions. So anyway, Bob, and for you and all of those out there, people that like to talk about those peripheral issues, those are the guys that are into the systems. So don't be mistaken. It's like, oh, he's just trying to upsell me, wants me to buy some more stuff I don't really need. That's true. For 90% of the storms that you encounter, you will not need those extras. For the 10% that really plays havoc, that is ice dam leaks, drywall, plaster damage, yes, you do need those pieces. So it's more of whether you're, what kind of philosophy you are as a consumer. I tend to prepare for the worst, because, you know, no matter what happens, sooner or later, the worst happens. You know, one day it's your turn. So in that regard, that's where I like to see flashing on the walls, where it's common for flashing to go up maybe 4 or 5 inches on the edge of a vertical wall behind siding. You know, we typically run something like an ice and water shield, or, you know, that roof membrane, and just run it up too high on the wall. So it goes up 12, 14, 16 inches. What's the harm? What's the risk? May cost you a whole roll or two of extra membrane, and it is where that blowing driving rain matters. Also, how the interfaces of flashing between siding and dormers, all those things matter. So for me, Bob, as you get into interviewing roofers, those are the guys that really want and know about the things that are important to a long-lasting roof. Phone lines are open, 314-436-7900, 436-7900. Toll-free from anywhere on the globe, 800-925-1120, 800-925-1120. My name is Scott Mosby. I'm at your service, sitting in for Mr. Rich Orris, taking off a couple of weeks of well-deserved vacation. So I hope Rich is enjoying himself wherever he be on the globe. Tip of the hat to you. 314-436-7900, 800-925-1120. When we come back, we're going to talk about my favorite, lumber futures, where we are in the economic cycle of purchasing, remodeling, whether it's time to build a custom home, how soon in your future is moving, why you move, why you don't move. There's so many things that affect a remodeling project from my world. So oftentimes we get invited out, I want to put on another master bedroom, so I want a 20 by 20 room addition, and that's it. And most guys will come back and say, okay, here's your 20 by 20 room addition, it's X dollars, and off we go. I want to know, what are you going to do in that room? How big does it need to be? Show me your closets around the rest of the house. What kind of a bathroom do you want? How far do you want that bathroom to be from those path areas? Would that bathroom or could that additional bathroom in that master suite serve as a guest bathroom, depending upon where the other one is in the house or whether it's accessible to guests? There are just so many things that if you're going to spend the money to do that project, look for as much trouble as you can, which is, to me, is just good design. You look forward into the future. You find out what matters. You advocate. You push a little bit that, you know, okay, so when you get up in the morning, do you read books later in the morning? Are you looking for a place to read a book? Is it likely that you'll have parents move in later years? Will you need perhaps assistance, medical assistance in our own later years in that house? Do you need more space for a caregiver? All those things that when you're doing some sort of a project like that, those design probing questions of, you know, where does it really hurt? What really matters? Because if you don't go far enough, you know, if you get 90% of what you need done and you're just a few thousand dollars from really answering all your needs for the next 20, 30 years, you missed by a little bit. 314-436-7900. Scott Mosby at your service. Toll free 800-925-1120. When we come back, we're going to talk about lumber futures and all sorts of things here. Right here on KMOX. All right, Midwestern KMOX. Scott Mosby, middle of the dial, middle of the day. This is the KMOX Home Improvement Show. We have two full hours, about an hour and 45 minutes left here, right on KMOX. At the top of the hour at noon, we pick up KFTK as a simulcast as well, which is how we got Rich Orris over here to KMOX in the first place. He was busy doing KFTK noon to 1. At the same time, I was broadcasting 11 to 1. And with my stepping aside, Rich Orris then became the host of both shows. Rich Orris taking some much-needed vacation right now. Let's go to the phone lines and see what's cooking here with Dale. Hey, Dale, good morning, sir. How may I help you this fine day? Hello, Dale. You on there? Uh-oh. Are you there, Dale? Did I lose you? My big fat fingers here, I'm having trouble. Oh. Whoa. I see you. Can't hear you. Uh-oh. I think I lost you. Dale, if you'd call right back here, 314-436-7900, we'll see what we can work out here. A little bit of technical difficulty on my end. Not surprising as I step into the big seat here. My fingers are a little fatter than they used to be and a little slower. Anyway, 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900. With the temperature getting up today in the higher degrees, we're going to sneak up close to 90 degrees. Relative humidity is close to 80, 85. I mean, it's humid out there. It's what we invented here in St. Louis as close. Yes, it is close indeed. Things related to that, again, it's important that you do change and replace your furnace filters. Those are important as you go in. Ideally, if you live by yourself, no pets, not much carpeting, that sort of thing, changing your furnace filters can be an occasional thing, maybe every 3 to 6 months. You'll notice when you put it in, it'll be a white fabric colored filter element. When you pull it out 3 months, 4 months later, you're looking for color, and the color would look like a gray dust there. Well, let's see if we can sneak up here on Dale one more time. Hey, Dale, Scott Mosby, how can I help, sir?
Hello, Scott.
All right, God bless you. I can. Maybe it was my own ears. I don't know, Dale.
No problem. Hey, I installed a new high-efficiency furnace about 4 years ago, and on my old furnaces, I had condensation going down the drain during the summertime, you know, from the drain hose.
Yeah.
This new furnace has no condensation dripping down the drain. Is there something wrong with the furnace, or is that a high efficiency furnace?
So you do have a condensate tubing going down there. So you
yes,
have the
I
plastic.
Do.
Yeah. Okay. So that's properly installed.
Yeah.
I'm surprised with the humidity that we have today, especially in the last couple of months, you should have condensate, should have liquid going down there. In the high efficiency, you don't get so cold. I mean, some of those high efficiency units only bring as much cooling or chilling as necessary. So it's not like 100,000% on, and that A coil is just really cold and it draws off a lot of condensation. However, one of the benefits of AC is dehumidifying the air. So I would have somebody come out and take a look at that, because oftentimes those pans plug up. You get a little scale off of those pans or just mineral buildup. After 4 years, you know, good old St. Louis water, you can have that problem. So I'd have somebody take a look at that condensate line, because you should have seen some water down at the base of the air handler on the floor, down on the concrete floor. But yeah, I'd have that checked.
I appreciate that, because I feel I should be getting some condensation. There's no water dripping on the floor around it like it was going over the pan, but I'll have it checked, okay?
Yeah, I would, because some of those pans, because furnaces get installed not quite perfectly plumb level and square, so a skinny pan or a short side can spill. So they may have made bigger pans, but you don't want standing water in there. That's bad mojo for health reasons. So there should be water coming out of that AC, especially today.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much, Scott.
All right, Dale, thanks. Good luck, my friend. So the purpose of condensate, what happens, to take it kind of through Dale's and my conversation. So in St. Louis, it's very high humidity. So when we have, say, 90% relative humidity, that means 90% of the maximum amount of water we can hang in that air. Well, that's like water sweat sitting next to our skin. The purpose of perspiration of us as humans, dogs panting, all that, is trying to get rid of heat. And the reason we perspire is so that that liquid that comes out in perspiration form, our sweat, that evaporates. Well, at 90% relative humidity, it doesn't evaporate, so our body is unable to cool itself as intended. So the purpose, or one of the biggest purposes of air conditioning, is dehumidifying, sucking and discharging the water from the air, so that the humidity inside your home, instead of being 90% outdoors, the relative humidity ideally in your home is somewhere in the summertime between 30% and 50%. Hard to get it down to 40% and 30% in the summer, because every time you open the door or window, every time that furnace pops on and you get a back, the makeup air or return air is not quite built into the house the way it should, it sucks in that outside humid air. So the point being is, one of the biggest services that air conditioner does for us is run slowly all the time, pulling humidity out of the air. And on a day like today, especially if it hits 90 degrees, that means that AC is going to work a good bit of time trying to drop from 90 degrees to 72 or 73, whatever you set your thermostat at. So that 20 degree delta means it's going to run a good amount of time. And the longer it runs, the more humidity it takes out. So here's one of the things that consumers, surely you've had this conversation with the heating and cooling guy in the last 40 years. Bigger used to be better. So if I don't ever want to be hot, so I want a great big air conditioner in my house back in the 1970s. Well, what happens is before we really understood air conditioning and refrigeration as a residential industry, that air conditioner would go on, cool the house in 5 minutes and shut off. And then it'd be off for the next 20 minutes. And then the temperature would warm up again. That doesn't really run long enough. When you have an oversized air conditioner, it doesn't run long enough to take the humidity out of the air. And it's possible that Dale's air conditioner is actually running fine, to the point that in some of the new air conditioners, the high efficiency units, they just deliver just enough of air movement, just enough of refrigeration, of cooling compressor, that, you know, it just kind of continuously runs, and there may be some condensate coming out, but very, very small amount because it's happening all the time. The best kind of air conditioner that runs is the one that runs pretty much all the time. Sounds odd, I know, but bear with me here, because you want that unit to run about 75-80% of the time. And when you get 100 degrees, 103 here in St. Louis, and people call up and they say, my air conditioner's not running right, it's running all the time. Well, it's designed, because every mechanical system has a design range that it's built for. So your house, say 3,000 square feet of house, probably three and a half ton air conditioning unit. If you have it too big, four and a half tons, your unit doesn't run enough. It doesn't dehumidify the air. You are not comfortable. So even though the thermostat may be set at 70, 69, 68, if you have humid air, if your air is too wet inside the house, your AC doesn't run long enough in elapsed time, It will require you to you'll be the same degree of comfort at 68 degrees with humid air inside your house as it is at 72 degrees with very dry air, because your body is now evaporating the perspiration from your skin and your body is able to help. So that's why the sizing of the AC unit is important, and why those condensate lines are so very important as well, because we want that water to get sucked out of the air by that big A coil that gets cold. So as the air comes through your ductwork, it goes past this A coil, slant coil, whatever looks like the radiator on your car with all the little metal fin things. So that's what's inside your air conditioning unit. And that gets cold, and the air comes through, and the wet air touches those cold fins, and those cold fins then, just like your glass of iced tea outside, little droplets of water form, and then they drip down into the pan. Pan fills up and drains off into this line that Dale and I were discussing. So anyway, just be aware that's how an air conditioner works. For those, I maybe went down a little far the rat hole or the rabbit hole here. I apologize, but it's very important that the condensation be removed from your air inside your house on any air conditioning unit, whether in your car, window air conditioning unit. That's why they drip outside. That's why they drip outside those windows when you stick them through the window unit. Split system, heating mini splits like the Mitsubishi and the Lennox and all the units that hang inside, you're hearing so much about now. Those have condensate drains, so they have a line discharging that condensate as well. Anyway, it's very important. 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900. Come on, you do-it-yourselfers. I know you're down doing battle, building that basement bathroom or finishing out your basement, whatever it is, replacing things. Today, it's better to get it done early. It'll be cooler now than it will in the next 2-3 hours. 314-436-7900. Scott Mosby sitting in place of Rich Orris, who is on vacation, taking a much-needed break. And I will return more after this right here on KMOX. All right. Benny Goodman, Home Improvement, 314-436-7900. Love the music. Drew Young, our producer in studio here, guiding me, keeping my fat fingers where they belong for the most part. He can't make magic, but he can certainly make radio. 314-436-7900, our phone line. Bring it on, bring it in. Vote early, vote often. Toll free, 800-925-1120. Next up on the phone, let's talk to my friend Kim. Hey, Kim, how you doing and how can I help?
Doing well, thank you very much. I want to know if I should leave the blower on for my central air unit all summer long, like I do in the wintertime.
Absolutely. There's just, other than 50 cents a month or maybe a few dollars a month, there's just no downside. What works in the winter works in the summer, because you, especially on a day like today, you get the side of a house in direct sun. You've got some extreme heat gain issues going on. So rather than have that foot of air next to your windows and that south wall or west wall that's getting so hot, if you keep that blower on, it just mixes it up just like a mix master in the kitchen. It's just good. I don't think I've turned off my furnace blower, golly, 15 years. You know, and I keep worrying about, you know, is it made for continuous duty operation? You know, in the HVAC, it's like, well, you know, the hardest thing on motors is starting them up. Like, okay, well, I'll just let it run. And I said, so if I break a motor, what's it going to cost me? It's like, installed maybe $200, $250, you know. It's like, well, I'll take that risk because, you know, 1 month of air conditioning or extreme heating can eat up that amount of money pretty quickly, too.
Can I ask something else real quick I just thought of?
Oh, yes, ma'am. You're my new favorite friend.
I have a fairly large walk-in closet, nothing over the top, but it's on the corner of the house, and there is no register and no return in there.
Wow.
I always leave the door open, which is kind of a nice eyesore. But... and I have gotten condensation in the corner before and a little mildew build up and bleached everything out. And is what prevention could I do besides run a fan in there? Just leave that door open? It hasn't happened since I left the door open.
Yeah, I would leave the door open for sure because in your extreme conditions, and it's mostly going to be in the winter time because that humid air inside the house is going to hit next to that outside wall, and that condensation is a real deal. And so yes, keep the door open, leave your blower motor on. That's another issue. So even though there's not a supplier return in that closet, you're still getting better circulation near that door, so it helps. And you know, frankly, you know, I would get one of those continuous duty fans, maybe oscillating fan that you sit in that closet and just let it move the air around. And then again, on those exterior walls, beware there, Kim, because where you get a cold wall in the winter and warm, moist air from the inside, you can grow a pretty good crop of mold and mildew on that wall surface and your clothes. You know, then whatever shoes or what's other stacked in there. Now you're sharing all that beautiful smell with the rest of the world.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Yeah, no kidding. It's a big deal, but, you know.
Yeah.
Sharing all your best mold with friends and family. What's not to love about that?
Yes. But yeah, because I have, like I said, I caught the problem in the past, and I just started leaving the door open, and it hasn't reared its ugly head again. But if I can prevent it from happening, but I hate to have a fan in there.
Well, I know, and you know, but again, if you get one of those vertical oscillating things, you don't have any real big risk. But I know that the noise is either something you like or something you don't. But really, it's your extreme. In the spring and the fall, I don't think it matters. But when you get into the deep summer and the deep winter, when you have extremes on the outside of the house and, you know, really dramatic differences from the out to in, then I would run that fan. I think you understand this pretty well, so I think you know exactly what to do.
Okay.
And
I'll go there.
Yeah, run that blower motor. There's just no downside. The only downside I've found is sometimes when I sit in a chair and it's right opposite that supply line, regardless of whether it's too hot or too cold, you know, it's just I'm sitting there in a breeze and it's cooling me off maybe more than I want sometimes. That's the only downside I've found with that fan.
Well, I appreciate your show, and thank you for answering all my questions.
All right, Kim, good luck. Thanks for the call. All right, Scott Mosby, Home Improvement, phone lines 314-436-7900, 800-925-1120. Some of the things Rich Orson and I have discussed over the years is kind of the nature of questions, kind of like Kim's here. She kind of already knew the answer. She just called in to kind of confirm whether or not her suspicions were right, or she wouldn't have asked. So she already had a, you know, suspicion that maybe I'll check and find out. So it's interesting, Rich and I tend to agree. All we do is confirm your suspicions. Very few times do we turn the boat around and head it the other direction. So if you're smart enough to call in here on KMOX 314-436-7900 and ask that question because you're concerned, chances are you already understand most of this stuff or you wouldn't have called. So anyway, that's why I call KMOX the smartest listening audience in the world. Let's go see what's cooking with my friend Evelyn. Hey, Evelyn, Scott Mosby here. KMOX, how can I help? Uh-oh, Evelyn, let me see if I get my big fat finger going here. Hold on. You there, Evelyn?
Yes, Mark. I am. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can. I can hear you. I just kind of walked around and lifted my leg for better reception here. Maybe that's it.
Okay. I just wondered what your opinion is on the insulation blankets that people recommend putting around water heaters.
Well, insulation blankets, on the more insulation you have on a water heater, basically the better. So there's really not a downside other than the cost. Now, depending upon the age of the age of that water heater, though, it also tells you kind of how much insulation is in there. And like buying a car, or you know, buying a suit or whatever you buy, you know, some are made better than others. So your better water heaters tend to have more insulation anyway, and the insulating the pipes. Generally, in a basement or where a water heater is, you don't lose that much temperature because it's a semi-conditioned area. So if you're trying to hit 70, 72 degrees upstairs, generally, you know, in the wintertime, the basement's going to be 60, 63. In the summertime, it might be, you know, the same. The point being that if you put more insulation around the water heater, it will indeed help. On a better water heater, not as much as if it were a cheap water heater. When you have a gas-fired water heater, if you're wrapping some combustible, some blanket around this thing, you better know what you're doing, where the flames are and where the vents are. So there is some risk of fire hazard, you know, if you start putting combustibles around a gas-fired water heater. On an electric water heater, you can pretty much envelop that thing with very little to no, you know, fire risk.
Okay, great. Well, that's very helpful. Thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am. Good question. Take care. Thanks, Evelyn. Let's see what's cooking. If I'm next up, let's see what's happening with my friend Sarah. Hey, Sarah. Scott Mosby here. How can I help?
Yes. Hi. I just had my exhaust chimney rebuilt, basically. It's brick. Mm. And one of the reasons why it had to be rebuilt was at the base, it became almost moldy. And it's eaten away at the mortar and the brick, and so I had it rebuilt and everything, and I just was curious about how to prevent that. I kind of forgot to ask the tuck pointing company, but how to maybe prevent that in the future.
Is this the chimney, the flue that your furnace and water heater vent into?
Yes.
Okay. Did anybody talk to you about lining that chimney with stainless steel?
You know, honestly, I don't think they did, but when I watched them rebuilding it, there was, they took everything apart. There was like this, it looked like aluminum to me, but it might have been stainless steel.
Yeah, yeah. So here's the game. How old is your house? When was your house built?
1929. I live in South City.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, you live in one of God's gifts to brick. You know, we are in Brick Town. We even have a town called Clay Town.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
As my father would say, your house is built for stout. But as it relates to furnaces, so when we had really inefficient gas furnaces, we used to blow 50% of the heat up the chimney. It just, you know, you fire it up, it comes on, it all goes up. But what it did is it dried out all of that chimney and masonry inside that flue liner of your chimney. So then we come into the 70s and the 80s, and it's like whiz bang, well, we need some more efficient energy, so we'll stop blowing 50% up the chimney. Let's try and preserve 70%. So we have a 70% efficient furnace instead of a 50%. 50% blows away half of it, so 70% only blows away 30%. So then that was okay. And then when we hit the 80%, high efficiency furnaces, we started running 20% of the heat up the chimney. And before it got out of that chimney, it would condense. It wasn't hot enough to carry the acids out with it, and it would drip acid down inside your whiz-bang, beautifully built masonry chimney and liner. And that's where then we started learning we need to put something that is acid resistant up these chimneys, because that acid will eat up all the masonry. So that's when you started hearing about, well, you know, for $800 or $1,800 or $20, whatever the price was depending upon the time, you now need to line that furnace, that chimney, with stainless steel so that the acid doesn't tear up your chimney again. So you really do need a chimney chimney liner put in if your furnace is anything 15 years or newer.
Okay. That's good to know. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and it's as you discovered, it's not a cheap date to get that. You know, bricklayers are fun to watch, but they're pricey, skilled tradesmen.
Oh yeah, they did a great job. So yeah, definitely. Thank you.
All right, take care. Good question. Thank you so much, Sarah. All right, Scott Mosby, Home Improvement, going to take a short pause for a break here. Come back for more after this on University of KMOX. Little chill. Oh, yeah, baby. Just sit back, listen to this music. Oh. Scott Mosby, Home Improvement, KMOX. Oh, pardon me, I've got a little bit of echo here. There we go. Okay, I'll put a finger in my one ear so I only hear it once instead of twice. There we go. We got it fixed. All right. Next up, let's see what's happening with my buddy Tim. Hey, Tim. Good morning. Welcome to KMOX. How can I help?
Hello, Scott.
Hello, Tim.
I have a porch below a heated and cooled living space. I have enclosed the porch, and in the ceiling of the porch runs flexible duct, and then it meets the metal ductwork, the sheet metal that feeds up to the air vent in the living space above it. And of course, where that meets, I'm getting a lot of condensation. I want to enclose this ceiling, and I was told by someone that I could dry it, wait for a day that's not humid, dry it, clean it, and spray that foam insulation on there, and that would solve it. But I wanted to double check with you.
That is exactly correct. So think of it as your cold can of Coke. You've got this cold drink, and it's very cold. You pulled it out of the fridge, it's 35 degrees, you take it outside. If you put a koozie on that, you just slide a koozie, you're now effectively putting foam on the outside of that can, and the only place can will condense is where it's not insulated or isolated. So the what you're being told is exactly correct. The one thing I will say is you have to be perfect in spraying that foam, and that means on the bottom underside of that foam, the side, the top, you have to, if you think you got it, you have to go too far. But spray foam is the most effective and best way to go about isolating and insulating that, because you're just putting a koozie on your cold drink. That's it.
Very
and
good.
It will
so
stop the
I really,
condensation.
Makes sense. So I really can't overdo it.
No. And I promise you, if you don't overdo it, you'll regret it.
Okay. Well, I won't. I'll put a layer on there and then check. And if it still sweats, I guess I could re-top it even.
Yeah, you can spray over it again. And it's not so much how thick you put it. I mean, the first half inch is going to be more than successful in isolating and insulating the moisture from touching that metal. It's the 100% or 110% coverage that matters because, you know, if you're up there like me, you only bend and stretch so far and, you know, half as much as we did 30 years. So the point is you know, if you're not hurting, you're not trying.
Okay. So any spray foam insulation?
Yeah, but you know that like the spray foam stuff that comes out of the small can. This is more like a looks like a propane small tank for a barbecue pit. These things run $500 or $600. They're expensive. They spray in a surface, and though we use them for band joists to put, you know, for just the same reason to keep the condensation from happening on a low insulated area. So they're pricey. They're really cumbersome to get up in that area, but they come with, you know, a line set, and we use them on insulating exterior walls on small bathrooms and showers where we just don't trust. You know what I mean?
Okay, I was hoping I could use like just a store bought aerosol can, but I guess that's not going to be proper.
Well, if you can, I just don't know of any of those that spray a fan like a paint sprayer does. You see what I mean? You know, anything that comes out of that little tube, and this, you know, the little tube might be where you, you know, stick it down underneath where the metal plenum connects with the flex duct. Maybe that's something for just having a hard time to get to it, because you're really using a paint spray gun to apply this product.
Okay. Well, thank you for the information. I like your show.
All right, Tim. Thanks. Good luck, my friend. You're on the right path. All right. Next up, let's see what's cooking with my buddy Greg. Hey, Greg, Scott Mosby here. I'm running out of time. How can I help?
Hey, I just wanted to edify you diagnosed that chimney and that liner correctly. I'm Greg with the English Sweep, and but a lot of times you got those older houses that used to have coal residue. You got to put a stainless steel liner down those. They hold the condensation from the furnace and water heater. But what we're seeing more of nowadays, that's creating a lot of that mold, is that people paint the chimney. This creates like a
barrier
all around the chimney, but mold builds up behind that paint. But those orphan water heaters going up the chimney have to be a liner in them also. To hold that condensation because they don't have the assistance of the furnace to help vent them. So that creates a lot of mold inside the chimney. But that lady should have her chimney sealed with a good waterproofing to help that brickwork last. And I just want to edify you, nailed it right on the head. And the other thing you mentioned earlier about the flashing around the with the ice and water shield, there's a lot of roofers out there who are just nailers, like you said. They're not tinners. But you get that ice and water shield and put new flashing, shingle flashing and counter flashing on, that stops a lot of those water leaks around the chimney.
Gosh, if everybody did all this work correct, Greg, you and I'd be out of a job, wouldn't it?
Well,
it just doesn't happen that way, does it?
Yeah, right, but, you know, that's the thing. I'd rather just do it once instead of going cheaply and have to redo it. Do it right the first time, and you don't have to worry about it.
All right. Greg of English Sweep. Thank you, my friend. Thank you. Scott Mosby, Home Improvement, wrapping up hour one. I promise to come back after news, weather, and sports. Stay tuned. Scott Mosby sitting in for Rich Orris on a much-needed vacation. I'll be back for more after this on KMOX. All right, Scott Mosby here. This is the Home Improvement Show, KFDK and KMOX, broadcasting to both stations simultaneously. Scott Mosby sitting in for my friend Rich Orris, who is on a much-needed vacation. So I hope Rich approves. I'm helping people the best I can. And we have phone lines open for your questions, 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900, and toll free 800-925-1120. My name is Scott Mosby. I work with Rich Orris as well at Mosby Building Arts, and it was an honor to spend many years servicing KMOX listeners as well through the radio show, and now even more of an honor to connect with KFTK listeners as well. So welcome aboard. Thank you for letting me fill in for Rich Orris. Phone numbers are all the same, 314-436-7900. As promised a little bit earlier, I'm going to get into the lumber futures and how that kind of ties in with some of the political talk. Kamala Harris, presidential candidate, wants to see 3 million homes built in the U.S. Certainly a worthy need. We can talk about that just a little bit. It is not a political commentary. It is a response to where the housing market is or is not and has been for the last 20 years. So we can talk about that a little bit later. 314-436-7900, 800-925-1120. Let's go see and talk to my friend Mildred. Hey, Mildred, good afternoon. Welcome to KMOX. How can I help?
Good afternoon, Scott, and thank you for taking my call. I was calling because I just saw something today. Naturally, I'm going to be replacing that roof and all, but I happened to see a water stain on the tile, on my roofing tile, and it looks like it's coming from the stack in the basement. The stack is probably as old as the house, which was built in 1939. And I'm wondering, should I be having the plumbers see that when I have them come to look at rerouting venting my hot water heater out the wall instead of up to the chimney like my furnace is doing. Who would be able to give me a better eye on that? The plumber or the roofer?
Probably both. First off, Mildred, good to hear your voice. I've missed you.
Well, I still haven't gotten anything done because it's all piling up, and I'm trying to get it together as to which is what priority is what. Because, of, like I say, that roof is the big deal. But also the tuck pointing of the chimney, the part about the hot water heater, because I want to, Rick had told me about, instead of investing in an electric water heater, just go ahead on and have it vented out like the furnace. I have a high-efficiency furnace that you have been talking about. So I want to have all of it vented out through the wall instead of up the chimney, and I'm going to close off that chimney because of the fact that, like you say, it's just so much going on with this whole house.
Right. Well, the last thing I would do would be the roof, because the roof covers up and kind of sweeps up all the details the other trades may have done. I would get your stack checked because of the age of the house. So make sure that the cast iron in that pipe is still solid, because the last thing I want to see is you get a new roof, you buttoned all this stuff, and it's all ship shape, and then you have to rip it apart to change that pipe. So I would make sure that you have a plumber check that stack. They can run a fiber optic camera down that and check it and see. But by age, if it's never been replaced, you're probably a candidate for, you know, a lot of plumbing as well. Yes, it is. It's a very invasive job. It's not hard work, but it's everywhere. It's surgery from the roof to the basement.
Right. I have been told that it is beginning to, crumble, from the basement portion. So I knew that. But I didn't know about that top until I happened to see it this morning. And so that, like I say, it threw up a red flag.
Well, your question is a really well-pointed question, because if the sidewall, and oddly enough, the stack that doesn't have water in it rusts out first. So when you use your sink or flush your toilet, all that water goes down, and then your vent up in the attic, it's the part in the wall above the water flow line that rusts first, because it keeps, there's more oxygen getting to that rusty. Yeah, it's counterintuitive. So what you expect to go first isn't the part that goes, and it could indeed explain your leak. So let's pretend that the side of that cast iron has now scaled and failed. There's a hole in it. So now your rain that comes down that, or condensate down your plumbing, could actually create a leak on your stack. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Thank you so very much, Scott. And it's good to hear from you, but I hope you're enjoying that vacation also.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much. Good to hear your voice. All right. There's a few folks that I come to count on over the years that called in, always have good questions, always have done their homework. And I feel good because I was able to help. And, regulars know who you are. Anyway, it glows my heart a little bit of warmth there. So thanks, Mildred. Next up, let's see what's cooking with my buddy Mike. Hey, Mike, Scott Mosby here. Good afternoon. Welcome to KFTK and KMOX. How can I help?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I'm in the middle of, I need to sister some floor joists in my crawl space. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, they're 14 foot long. They run from a steel beam, the center of the house, back over to the foundation. Okay. I was able to get one floor joist in the position, but now I need to know the best way to get it to stand it up, if you follow what I mean.
I sure do. I feel your pain. Sometimes you have to trim the width of the floor joist. So the old floor joist, let's pretend, is 11 and a quarter inches tall on a 2x12. It's possible your newly milled a replacement joist might be 12 and a half inches or 12 and 3/8. And then when you pull the diagonal on that board from long corner to long corner, when you're trying to tip that puppy up, you may hump that floor up as much as 1/4 to 3/8 of an inch and cause even more damage. So beware brutalizing this thing into place, because you can push up on the floor above pretty dramatically. And frankly, when you have a failed joist, any reason to sister it, it's already sagged down more than you would like.
Right.
So I might, the problem here could be the sag in the floor from the failed old joist. So I may suggest that you set up some jacks along the length of that old floor joist, and over do a tiny bit of turn every day for the next 7 or 10 days to push up and flatten out the floor structure above. Because if your new sister joist is straight and the old one looks like a horse's sway back, you're really lifting as you try and put that sister joist in place. You follow what I'm saying?
I do. And how many of those would you jack at one time? Because I'm looking at a total of probably a dozen of these I'm going to have to do.
Oh, my. Ideally, I'd do them all at the same time. And the jacking up could be as simple as a 2x4, you know, a 2x12 on the floor, 2x12 up in the ceiling on the underside of the floor deck, and prop that. Ideally, you do it with a screw jack where you can very surgically raise that a bit. But if you've got 12 feet of sagged or failed old joist that you're trying to sister, first off, you're doing the right thing. But I don't think you're ready to put those joists in place unless they go in pretty easily. You know what I mean?
Okay. So just, can I get all the new sistered floor joists in the place, lay them flat, and then over time raise that up? Like you said, a little bit at a time, you know, over a period of a week or so, get it raised up. So I think if I can get them raised up about 3/4 to an inch, I'd probably be good.
Well, if you can get them up, is that close to straight? Will that take it back to where it was mostly?
I think so.
3/4 of an inch is a boatload. That's a lot of sag. So, I mean, if you're sistering your joist on the east side of the old floor joist, then you would do your jacking and propping on the west side of that floor joist, on the other side, so that you're kind of lifting it all up, taking the load off the old floor joist, because you're still going to get some structure out of that old floor joist. And remember, you know, pull your wiring out, you know, get stuff out of the way, because, you know, you need
everything's
all
pretty clear. Everything's pretty clear where I'm at. And how close to the footing should I, because that's where the sag is, where it goes from the center of the house to the footing. So how far off from the footing would I come back?
Center of the span. Center of the span. Yeah, your floor, you're not lifting, you know, 40 pounds a square. You're not lifting the house. You're only unsagging that floor section. So you're not, you don't have to worry about tons. You're worried about maybe 800 pounds per floor joist that you're trying to push back up. So you can, as long as you spread out the load of that jack or the 2x4 on the floor, lay a 2x4 flat, which is now a new footing on top of that concrete floor. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I got crawl space.
Well, that's fine. That's fine. But if, you know, but you need a wider footer, so you need a flat something underneath each one of those jacks or 2x4s to lift that up.
Right. I was just going to use, my floor joists are actually 2x10s. So I was going to use one of them.
Yeah. Perfect.
Lay it flat.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going about this the right way. Just be very slow, deliberate, and patient, because you're lifting up the old stuff a good bit. And don't worry about being too close to the footing or not. You just want to get the whole thing up, and if you could pull a string on it or just use an eye line just to see what the bottom of that floor joist looks like. And you're probably going to leave the old floor joist with a sag in it and somewhat start pushing the floor decking off of that old sag floor joist. Follow
all right.
me?
Yes, that sounds very good. Thanks for
yep.
the help.
I think you're on top of this thing.
All right, Scott. Nice hearing you. Thanks.
Good luck. Hope you can stand up when you're halfway done with this puppy. Thanks, Elias. Take care. Thanks, Mike. It's a big deal to both stations simultaneously. Scott Mosby sitting in for my friend Rich Orris, who is on a much-needed vacation. So I hope Rich approves. I'm helping people the best I can. And we have phone lines open for your questions, 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900, and toll free 800-925-1120. My name is Scott Mosby. I work with Rich Orris as well at Mosby Building Arts, and it was an honor to spend many years servicing KMOX listeners as well through the radio show, and now even more of an honor to connect with KFTK listeners as well. So welcome aboard. Thank you for letting me fill in for Rich Orris. Phone lines, phone numbers are all the same, 314-436-7900. As promised a little bit earlier, I'm going to get into the lumber futures and how that kind of ties in with some of the political talk. Kamala Harris, presidential candidate, wants to see 3 million homes built in the U.S. Certainly a worthy need. We can talk about that just a little bit. It is not a political commentary. It is a response to where the housing market is or is not and has been for the last 20 years. So we can talk about that a little bit later. 314-436-7900, 800-925-1120. Let's go see and talk to my friend Mildred. Hey, Mildred, good afternoon. Welcome to KMOX. How can I help?
Good afternoon, Scott, and thank you for taking my call. I was calling because I just saw something today. Naturally, I'm going to be replacing that roof and all, but I happened to see a water spot stain on the tile, on my roofing tile, and it looked like it's coming from the stack in the basement. The stack is probably as old as the house, which was built in 1939, and I'm wondering, should I be having the plumbers see that when I have them come to look at rerouting venting my hot water heater out the wall instead of up to the chimney like my furnace is doing? Who would be able to give me a better eye on that? The plumber or the roofer?
Probably both. First off, Mildred, good to hear your voice. I've missed you.
Well, I still haven't gotten anything done because it's all piling up. And I'm trying to get it together as to which is what priority is what. Because, of, like I say, that roof is the big deal. But also the tuck pointing of the chimney, the part about the hot water heater. Because I want to, Rick had told me about, instead of investing in an electric water heater, just go ahead on and have it vented out like the furnace. I have a high-efficiency furnace that you have been talking about. So I want to have all of it vented out through the wall instead of up the chimney, and I'm going to close off that chimney because of the fact that, like you say, it's just so much going on with this old house.
Right. Well, the last thing I would do would be the roof, because the roof covers up and kind of sweeps up all the details the other trades may have done. I would get your stack checked because of the age of the house, so make sure that the cast iron in that pipe is still solid, because the last thing I want to see is you get a new roof, you buttoned all this stuff, and it's all ship shape, and then you have to rip it apart to change that pipe. So I would make sure that you have a plumber check that stack. They can run a fiber optic camera down that and check it and see, but by age, if it's never been replaced, you're probably a candidate for a lot of plumbing as well. Yes, it is. It's a very invasive job. It's not hard work, but it's everywhere. It's surgery from the roof to the basement.
Right. I have been told that it is beginning to, crumble, from the basement portion. So I knew that but yeah. I didn't know about that top until I happened to see it this morning. And so that, I could say, it threw up a red flag.
Well, your question is a really well pointed question, because if the sidewall, and oddly enough, the stack that doesn't have water in it rusts out first. So when you use your sink or flush your toilet, all that water goes down, and then your vent up in the attic, it's the part in the wall above the water flow line that rusts first, because it keeps, there's more oxygen getting to that rusty. Yeah, it's counterintuitive. So what you expect to go first isn't the part that goes, and it could indeed explain your leak. So let's pretend that the side of that cast iron has now scaled and failed. There's a hole in it. So now your rain that comes down that, or condensate down your plumbing, could actually create a leak on your stack. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Thank you so very much, Scott, and it's good to hear from you, but I hope you're enjoying that vacation also.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much. Good to hear your voice. All right. There's a few folks that I come to count on over the years that called in, always have good questions, always have done their homework, and I feel good because I was able to help. And, you know, you regulars know who you are. Anyway, it glows my heart a little bit of warmth there. So thanks, Mildred. Next up, let's see what's cooking with my buddy Mike. Hey, Mike, Scott Mosby here. Good afternoon. Welcome to KFTK and KMOX. How can I help?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I'm in the middle of, I need to sister some floor joists in my crawl space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically, they're 14 foot long. They run from a steel beam, the center of the house, back over to the foundation. Okay. I was able to get one floor joist in the position, but now I need to know the best way to get it to stand it up, if you follow what I mean.
I sure do. I feel your pain. Sometimes you have to trim the width of the floor joist. So the old floor joist, let's pretend, is 11 1/4 inches tall on a 2x12. It's possible your newly milled replacement joist might be 12 1/2 inches or 12 3/8. And then when you pull the diagonal on that board from long corner to long corner, when you're trying to tip that puppy up, you may hump that floor up as much as 1/4 to 3/8 of an inch and cause even more damage. So beware brutalizing this thing into place, because you can push up on the floor above pretty dramatically. And frankly, when you have a failed joist, any reason to sister it, it's already sagged down more than you would like.
Right.
So I might the problem here could be the sag in the floor from the failed old joist. So I may suggest that you set up some jacks along the length of that old floor joist, and over do a tiny bit of turn every day for the next 7 or 10 days to push up and flatten out the floor structure above. Because if your new sister joist is straight and the old one looks like a horse's sway back, you're really lifting as you try and put that sister joist in place. You follow what I'm saying?
I do. And how many of those would you jack at one time? Because I'm looking at a total of probably a dozen of these I'm going to have to do.
Oh, my. Ideally, I'd do them all at the same time. And the jacking up could be as simple as a 2x4, you know, a 2x12 on the floor, 2x12 up in the ceiling on the underside of the floor deck, and prop that. Ideally, you do it with a screw jack where you can very surgically raise that a bit. But if you've got 12 feet of sagged or failed old joist that you're trying to sister, first off, you're doing the right thing. But I don't think you're ready to put those joists in place unless they go in pretty easily. You know what I mean?
Okay. So just, can I get all the new sistered floor joists in the place, lay them flat, and then over time raise that up? Like you said, a little bit at a time, you know, over a period of a week or so, get it raised up. So I think if I can get them raised up about 3/4 to an inch, I'd probably be good.
Well, if you can get them up, is that close to straight? Will that take it back to where it was mostly?
I think so.
3/4 of an inch is a boatload. That's a that's a lot of sag. So, I mean, if you're sistering your joist on the east side of the old floor joist, then you would do your jacking and propping on the west side of that floor joist, on the other side, so that you're kind of lifting it all up, taking the load off the old floor joist, because you're still going to get some structure out of that old floor joist. And remember, you know, pull your wiring out, you know, get stuff out of the way, because, you know, you need
everything's
all
pretty clear. Everything's pretty clear where I'm at. And how close to the footing should I? Because that's where the sag is, where it goes from the center of the house to the footing.
Mm-hmm.
So how far off from the footing would I come back?
Center of the span. Center of the span. Yeah, your floor. You're not lifting. You know, 40 pounds a square. You're not lifting the house. You're only unsagging that floor section. So you're not. You don't have to worry about tons. You're worried about maybe 800 pounds per floor joist that you're trying to push back up. So you can, as long as you spread out the load of that jack or the 2x4 on the floor, lay a 2x4 flat, which is now a new footing on top of that concrete floor. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I got rock. I got a rock. Got crawl space.
Well, that's fine. That's fine. But if you know, but you need a wider footer, so you need a flat something underneath each one of those jacks or 2x4s to lift that up.
Right. I was just going to use my floor joists are actually 2x10s. So I was going to use one of them.
Yeah. Perfect.
Lay it flat.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going about this the right way. Just be very slow, deliberate, and patient. Because you're lifting up the old stuff a good bit. And don't worry about being too close to the footing or not. You just want to get the whole thing up. And the, if you could pull a string on it or just use an eye line just to see what the bottom of that floor joist looks like. And you're probably going to leave the old floor joist with a sag in it and somewhat start pushing the floor decking off of that old sag floor joist. Follow
all right. Yes, that sounds very good. Thanks for
yep.
help.
I think you're on top of this thing.
All right, Scott. Nice hearing you. Thanks.
Good luck. Hope you can stand up when you're halfway done with this puppy. Thanks, Elias. Take care. Thanks, Mike. It's a big deal. What Mike is undertaking is done by professionals all the time, and this is one of those jobs that you spend $50, and you know it's $5 for turning the screw and $45 for knowing which one to turn. So Mike being able to do this himself, it takes a lot of labor time to professionally do this slowly, but if you can do this yourself, you can save a lot of money because it's a time labor intensive thing. It does take some high skills, so it sounds like Mike's on top of this. 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900. Welcome to KFTK, Camo X listeners, both alike. Scott Mosby here sitting in for Rich Orris. I'll take a short pause and come back for more after this. All right, folks, Scott Mosby back at your service here instead of Rich Orris, who is taking a much-needed vacation. I hope Rich is enjoying himself, time with his family and his new grandchild. Maybe not so new grandchild, anyway. Scott Mosby here at your service. Phone lines open, 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900, 800-925-1120. We are broadcasting KFTK and KMOX simulcast, so voice and signals going out together. Glad to be here serving you both. Let's go to my friend Elias and see what's cooking. Elias, good afternoon. Welcome. How may I help today?
Thank you. Nice to hear your voice, Scott. Listen, I am in project. We want to change the bathtub to a shower.
Yes.
And the house is built back in 1951. I think the bathtub, it is in good condition, but it's cast iron, all right?
Yes, sir.
And we don't have a basement. We have crawl space.
Okay.
Now, what do I look when the man comes and you want to take the bathtub out?
Well, frankly, they will break that cast iron bathtub out with a sledgehammer.
Okay.
So because the tub lip, so when the bathtub comes up on the side, it then comes out to the edge, that lip where it goes up to the wall, it goes under the tile usually, and then there's another lip that goes vertically up the wall about an inch or an inch and a half, so that right. any water that comes down the tile or the fiberglass, whatever the surface is, stays in type inside that tub. So to get that bathtub out, the tile will be demolished, usually about 6 inches all the way around that bathtub. And generally, there isn't a lip on the front face of the bathtub vertical. So when you come into the bathroom and you look right at the tub or off to the side, that face does not have a lip. Every place else does. So getting that tub out, you have to demolish everything around it, or you just break it up like a big piece of glass. And it is... It is loud. It is dangerous because you're slamming a sledgehammer on porcelain, which means glass. So you have glass, you know, shards of flying glass. So it's not for the faint of heart. And then after that, you then figure out where your shower base. The shower base goes in just exactly like the bathtub, with those same lips that go up vertically and usually out on the front face as well. So that the old tub would come out. You're probably standing on ceramic tile, Elias, and that tile might be an inch and a half thick or an inch thick down to the 1x8 floor sheathing, if you will. So that stuff, the boards that run probably diagonally on top of your floor joists. So that new shower base would sit down on that wood. So sometimes you have to add another layer of plywood to level it out or even out that surface, and then install your shower base. And then they come back in and either remove the old tile on the walls all the way up, usually the plaster on that age house, and you know, go back in. The old tile can stay in place if you want to, but it's a better job if you remove the old stuff, take it all the way down to the 2x4s, number one, because then you get to see if there are any water problems, any rod or problems with that. You can really insulate it very well between the studs, especially if it's an exterior wall. If you're going to go from a tub to a shower and you have a window in that tub now, I would very much advise that you consider changing that window at the same time so that all the water management from the outside and the inside can be buttoned up, because you've got one company responsible for all of that.
Yeah. The window is not in the tub. It is next to it, you see. Okay. I have tiles now, like 4x4,
yeah,
and it's beige. I'm not going to find anything, like 3/4 of the... bathtub, no. But we decided to take the tiles out and put some onyx, you see?
Yeah.
From the ceiling to the down to the floor. Okay.
Yes.
And do you think onyx is better than plastic tile? You know, like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's more like stone. It costs a few dollars more, but it's more like a solid surface. You know, it's we use onyx a lot. I like the onyx is a newer, more reliable version to cultured marble for the listeners out there.
Yeah.
So, but we use a lot of onyx. Love the polyester nature of it, and and it has no joints. There's no grout. You know, all you have to be responsible for is the corner caulk joint and the bottom caulk at the shower base. It's pretty idiotic.
After all, it made in Kansas City, right?
Yeah. Out in Kansas. Yeah, not far from here.
Right. Yeah. So, and next, we have still have the toilet 5 gallon tank. If I put in your one, would be not the same donuts. You know, to sit on the commode, right?
Right.
Because
correct.
I'm going to put 1.5 gallon tank.
Yeah. Well, think about it. So the height of what will you do with your existing floor tile? Because it's that you may need to raise that collar if you're going to put new tile on the floor. And usually you have to do something with that because of the shower base going in. So it's the height of that collar between that collar where that donut goes that you have to pay attention to.
Yeah, we plan to change the floor, now it's a plastic, to a tiles or whatever, anything, you know, the whole thing, right?
Yeah. No, I like where you're going with this, Elias.
Yeah. So, I mean, as I said, the house built 1951, it's time to change because, I use a top once, okay, and my wife take a shower, so no need for that. Again, if you sell the house, a senior citizen comes and want to buy the house, it's easy to go to the shower more than take over the top, which is like 15 inches high, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Boy, do I do. I surely know what you mean. That's a leap of faith at later years.
Yes, right. Yeah. One time I went to Jefferson City, went to the hotel down there. Man, the top is almost 10 inches high. I said, whoa. This is too high. Anyway, well, thank you for the ideas. You know, I keep this in mind, you know, till next week to see, you know, where we go with this. Again, it's a lot of dust, right?
Oh, yeah. It's it can be done pretty quickly. You can get that bathroom done, even with the cultured marble, in about a week to 10 days, you know, because if they order all the stuff correctly, you know, if you hire this out, then it's a pretty quick turn, but it is dusty. I mean, it's deep inside your house. There's no easy, they can't come from the outside to get there. They have to come all the way through your house to get to it. So,
right. Yeah, it's right. Yeah. So,
yes, sir.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Elias.
Again, not spoken to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck. Good to hear your voice again. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye now. Scott Mosby, Home Improvement, sitting in for Rich Orris on both stations, KFTK, KMOX. It's kind of fun to be back, hear the old voices, and talk to the family, if you will. 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900, 800-925-1120. I promised a little bit about lumber futures, and I'll get into the disparate housing needs, what's behind presidential candidates. Kamala Harris proposing 3 million new households. The numbers, and I've been a member of the National Association of Home Builders, almost from diapers, I think. So I've followed the number of houses. It's estimated by NAHB, National Association of Home Builders, we need about 1.6 million homes, new homes created every year to replace the ones that are wearing out, that are just no longer financially viable. So we need home builders to create 1.6 million for the last 20 years, maybe now 25. On the average, there's only 2 or 3 years where we built that many homes as an industry of 1.6 or 1.8 or even 1.45. So we've been underbuilding the housing supply for over two decades. And now we find ourselves with no houses for sale. The houses that are for sale, people are not letting go because of the supply and demand. The values of those existing homes have gone up and up and up, and then compound that with a little bit of inflation. So now that stack of building materials is just worth more than it was before. So frankly, it's interesting. It gets my attention because 3 million new housing units per year, it would still take us 10 years at that rate to neutralize the underbuilding that the industry has, because as builders, you know, we go out and we borrow money and we buy the materials, we put up the house, hope somebody comes out and buy it. You know, maybe they buy it somewhere halfway through. So it's a risky business. It's not for the faint of heart, and it's a capital intensive. I personally don't build new homes. We're in the remodeling business just for that reason, because we kind of believe in recycling, if you will. So, you know, taking a good stock house, you know, and putting a new life on it, give it a new 50 or 70 years. It's not going to the landfill, yada, yada, yada. It's in close-in areas where everybody wants to live, close to all their friends and church and grocery, all that stuff. But the point being that as an industry, we're just grotesquely underbuilt for a very long time. So I'm happy to hear this. Every presidential candidate for the last 25, 30 years has met with the home builders to try and figure this out. Every time we improve the building code and add a feature or change stair geometry, make the height of the stair risers a little less for safety reasons, makes the stairs longer, makes the house bigger, makes the purchase price even higher. So a lot of the dynamics in housing is and has resulted in almost no starter houses being built because they're just as risky as a bigger home. But the baby boomers are buying 3/4 of the houses now. The Gen X, the younger generation, is now looking for homes. They're buying houses that are much bigger as well. So we still have this terribly underbuilt situation for new homes, for starter homes. Anyway, so I like getting the conversation going. It's a worthy topic, but I don't think you realize how far underwater we are underbuilt in the housing supply. But I'm sure you pondered, you know, they want that much money for that house? Well, that's why, because there aren't new homes coming online to replace them to offer the new home buyers an option at a newer home. They have to buy that older one because it's the only one available. Anyway, 314-436-7900, 800-925-1120. I'll get into lumber futures in a little bit, which ties into this a little bit. So anyway, I just find the whole thing interesting because, I love current events. And I love this industry because it fixes one of Maslow's main hierarchy of needs of, housing. So, big deal. Scott Mosby, Home Improvement. We'll be right back for more after this. 314-436-7900, 800-925-1120. Scott Mosby sitting in for Rich Orris, and I'll be right back. All right, welcome back together, Scott Mosby, Home Improvement, KFTK, KMOX, simulcasting. I sit in today for Rich Orris, taking some valuable time away. Rich is an industrious guy, and he's a busy guy. He does a lot of troubleshooting in the industry, gets around a good bit, high service, high intelligence, and he understands things, as you well know. Nice to be back on the radio. Nice to talk to my old friends, and I'm enjoying it. Anyway, what can I say? Good to be home. 314-436-7900 is the phone number to put us together. Bring them on. Vote early. Vote often. Toll free, 800-925-1120. Let's next go up to my friend Bob and see what's cooking. Bob, good afternoon. How can I help you this fine day?
I have my roof is getting some mold on it. It's a very shady area, and I just wanted the what you recommend as far as alleviating this problem. Do I mix some bleach and spray with water and spray it on, or then wash it off, or what?
Yes. If you're safely comfortable on the roof, the answer is yes. What that is mold and mildew. What happens is the morning dew sets on your shingles, then the dust sticks to the dew, and then the next day it comes and the dew makes it warm. You get a little layer of topsoil going up on those shingles right in between the granules. And so you wind up holding the moisture and an organic food source. Then you get leaves and dust and other things. So you're growing a nice little crop of mold or mildew, if you will, on those shingles. Power washer will blow the granules right off the shingles, so that's not a good choice unless you're a professional. You know exactly how to use one of those machines because pressure is not your friend. The issue is get up there with a little bit of detergent and some bleach. What happens, you need to kind of push it with a plastic bristle push broom because you need to mechanically abrade it. You need to get that topsoil out from in between those little granules. So wet it down, put a little detergent. I like to hit it with soap detergent the first time, get most of the solids off because the chlorine, the bleach is not good for the plants and the grass and the stuff down below on off the edge of the roof or even in the gutters. So the point is wash it once, rinse it once, go back with the bleach. You can actually scrub it off the second time or just let the bleach sit. It will brighten up mostly. You'll get most of it improving by at least 50%. That's the good news. The bad news is 3 years later, it'll be back.
My other question is, can I just use like a spray can with those and yep. just spray it on?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Low tech, very low tech on the whole thing. I just typically put a 5-gallon bucket of detergent up there, usually Dawn or some emulsifier like that for the first one, and then for spraying the bleach up. And you can do it without washing it off. It just will last an either even shorter time.
It won't stain the roof or anything like that?
It won't what?
Will it stain the roof with the, you know, leaving the bleach on, or should you rinse it off?
No, it doesn't really hurt the granules or the shingles at all. It really just goes after the stuff, the mold and the mildew. It's a long word, like Glowio and capsule, something like that. It's just a long something. Now, to prevent it in the future, if you ever replace your shingles, if you look on the roof, if you have where the plumbing stack comes up, if you have a lead pipe stack flashing on that, you'll notice that below that pipe, there is no mildew coming straight down from that pipe, or sometimes from a galvanized sheet metal flashing on the side. So copper and zinc, my father back in the 1940s and 50s when this company was started, when he built a home, he used to take a sheet of zinc up on the cap, and before the roof ridge cap was nailed on, he'd leave a half inch of this zinc strip. Some people put galvanized sheet metal up there, and that zinc and or copper in the granules of new roofs, that will keep that material, that mold and mildew, from growing for like 10 or 15 years. Nowadays, you can get shingles that have this copper or mildewcide built in. What it means is they put a little bit of copper granules in on that roof shingle, and that will prevent that from happening, or substantially prevent that from happening for a long time. So your best bet, when you get tired of cleaning this, is replace your roof with one of those better whiz-bang type roof shingles.
Very good.
Yes, sir. You're not alone. Everybody's got this thing. It's St. Louis. We invented humidity. All right. Appreciate it. Good question on that as well, because, Bob, the mold on the roof is everywhere. Everybody seems to have it. It's easy to wash off. Also, for those of you facing vinyl siding where you have the same mildew growing, moss only grows on the north side of trees where the sun doesn't get to it, where the wind doesn't so much get to it. Well, when you have a house with artificial siding, that same condensation, the same water droplets, the same dust all winds up on older vinyl siding. So on older vinyl siding on a house, that vinyl then opens up, the pores are open, it's not shiny anymore. So you can grow a pretty nasty crop of mildew and mold on the side of a house on many different kinds. It's more prevalent in that older vinyl siding. The steel, because of the way the old steel siding was there, or the aluminum, is not quite as prone to it, but it can have a little bit, vinyl being the toughest one. Let's go and see what's happening with my buddy Dave. Hey, Dave, Scott Mosby here. How can I help you this fine day?
Yes, Scott, I was tiling my shower, and I messed up. So I had to take, after a couple of days, I had to take the tile off. And I was wondering, what is there any kind of an easy way of getting that thin-set mortar back off of the board, or what's the best way of getting that mortar back off?
I don't have... the best way is remove the Duroc cement board with it.
Take the whole thing off?
Yeah, it's the same thing with plaster and lath. So if you ever did demo on an old house, you'll find that getting the plaster off in 3/4 of an inch thick and trying to keep all the wood lath or the metal lath or whatever, it's just a fool's errand. You're better off just pulling the whole thing off at one piece. We see it in floor demolition when we're trying to take up a kitchen floor and there are 2 or 3 layers of floor. You know, peeling one off might take you 12 hours. Peeling all 3 layers off in one big piece might take you 4 hours. So that's kind of what you're facing. By the way, if you the best way to take that tile off is with a chisel from the side. The problem is that to get off that and the thin set, you will wind up caulking and damaging the Duroc anyway. So when you get all done with doing it the hard way, you're going to sit back and go, oh, what a mess. I'm just going to change that stuff anyway. So you might as well just go at it.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. I didn't think there was an easy way of getting that off of there. Yeah, that's stuck on there pretty hard.
Yeah, okay. When you do it the right way, it's as my dad says, it's built for stout. And, you know, now you've done it. You got to undone it now.
Exactly. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Good luck, Dave. I think when you get in there, you'll piddle around with it. You'll find out that, yeah, it's a lot easier taking this whole thing off.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's what I'll do.
All right, Dave. Okay. Take care, my friend.
Thank you. Right. You too.
Bye now. Home Improvement, Scott Mosby, KMWX. It's nice to help. There's a helping issue here that, you know, it's nice to go to sleep at night and say, yeah, you know, I helped a few people today. You know, move the ball forward. We're better off than where we were this morning. So nice to be back on the horse. Okay, back to the horse. Speaking of lumber futures. So for those of you, you know, I'm a geek. I'm sorry. You know, I'm a geek. I'm kind of sorry there. But lumber futures are a measure of supply and demand of future lumber. So when interest rates are dropping, home sales are rising, then the value of that lumber is more important. So they sell lumber next month and 2 months forward and 3 months forward. So the future crop of lumber harvest. So anyway, I'll get into that a little bit more at the end of the hour here. But the futures of lumber, despite even with our interest rates coming down just a little bit, the lumber futures have come back up over the last few months here. So we're like $530 for 1,000 board feet delivered next month in September. Anyway, Scott Mosby, Home Improvement. Take a short pause, step away, and be right back for more after this. All right, back together. Scott Mosby wrapping up. Got about just one more minute. Let's see if I can sneak in Elizabeth. Elizabeth, good afternoon. How can I help you?
Hi, how are you doing?
Wondermous. How about yourself?
I'm wonderful. I have a suggestion on how that guy can get the tile off the wall.
Yeah,
he did. I didn't hear how big a space that was, but I removed the tile from my bathroom. My house was built in the early 60s, and this was the original tile to the house.
Yeah.
And what I did was I took my oscillating saw, went through the grout lines, and then I took the heat gun and heated up the thin set, and then I just popped it off with a 5-in-1.
Ah.
And it all came off of the drywall, because I don't have plaster. I've got drywall.
Well, that was with the vinyl adhesive, not the thin. That's so vinyl adhesive will heat up with a heat gun like that. That's true.
Wow. 60 years ago, I don't know what they used because it's the original stuff.
Understood. Thanks, Elizabeth. Heat gun. I'll pass it on. Thank you so much. All right, Scott Mosby, Home Improvement. Elizabeth, thank you so much. Let me see, who was pulling tile off of that? It is what it is. I guess Dave there, tiling his shower. Scott Mosby, Home Improvement. Stay tuned. Been nice to see you. See you next week.